Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have an important show, I think quite exciting, not a topic that people don't talk a lot about. We're going to have a return guest, someone who I respect highly, and it's been a while since he's been on the show, but every time Mr. Smith comes on, it's a wealth of information. We're going to speak with Mr. Wesley Smith. He's an author. He is a maven, I would say, on thinking about things outside the box. And it's about public advocacy and about how we as individuals, I think, are able to run our lives in a way that we see fit. And he's written for everything from Newsweek, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. He's appeared on TV and radio stations such as ABC Nightline, Good Morning America. And he is, I think he has a pulse, finger on the pulse of what our society has become. So today we're going to have a conversation about an article that he wrote. And first of all, Mr. Smith, I want to welcome you back to the show.
Well, thank you, Dr. George. Good to be here again.
It's a pleasure. And last time we spoke, and in the past, we spoke about bioethicists. And I find that it's almost like a misnomer. You would think that it's about ethics, it's about humanity, and it's about everybody thriving and being individuals. And it never seems to turn out that way. And you wrote a really interesting article about psychedelics. And I've heard a lot recently about how they're making a comeback, that it's medicinal, that it helps people to explore, I guess, themselves. And I wanted to get your take on it. So again, welcome. And what made you write this article? I guess that's my first question.
Well, thanks. I wrote this article in National Review. It's in NRO. Because you had a couple of bosses stating or opining that rather than limit psychedelics to potential use in terms of treatment for things like depression, which is under study, but that it also should be used to make a life interesting. Well, what that means is basically recreational use. And so you're talking about people writing in some of the highest levels of medical literature, bioethics literature, basically about people, I don't know if you remember Dr. Timothy Leary, but saying out, tune out and tune in, mm-hmm. Basically to take psychedelics for recreational use. And so I wrote, you know, wait a second. Exploring it in terms of psychiatric use is one thing. And the FDA thinks that it's possible that these drugs can be used for certain uses in that regard. In fact, they've actually labeled some psychedelics like the mushrooms drugs because they're showing some good results in treating depression. But there's another thing to say, well, okay, we're going to use it to get high and to have trips. It's like morphine. Morphine can be used to ameliorate pain. It's very important pain medication, particularly for people with serious conditions like cancer. But if you take morphine to get high, it's a completely different thing and becomes addicting. So you have a dual uses on some of these very strong substances. And I wanted to point out that there was an attempt, or at least seems to be an attempt beginning, to move the psychedelic investigation from and use from potentially therapeutic uses into recreational uses, which would be, I think, a terrible mistake.
Well, you know, my take on the hallucinogens or hallucinogenic effect of this is it removes the person from, I think, a God consciousness, right? That it's about being completely oblivious and being open, technically, to whatever the experience is. And
you know what's interesting, Dr. George, just an hour and a half ago before we're taping this, I actually taped my own podcast, which is called Humanize, with a former hockey star who used psychedelics to treat his traumatic brain injury caused by concussions. Mm-hmm. And we had that very discussion, and I asked him about the experience he had, and it really was kind of a situation where he was finding himself. But I think you're right about that, because instead of finding one's self and one's purpose in God, one finds it within the hallucination, which he admitted it is. Mm-hmm. When you're on a psychedelic, it's a hallucination. You find yourself within an hallucination. Well, those are, if one believes in God, God's not an hallucination. And if one is seeking to find purpose in hallucinations, that can lead to, I think, some very disturbing consequences.
From a standpoint, from the, you know, the neurological and the pharmacokinetic side of this, I mean, you know, I was a little kid when this was, LSD was out there, but you've heard these stories of people who, they may take a trip and it keeps happening. I mean, is this something that can be controlled aside just on a human level, on a physical level? Is there something that people should be afraid of?
I think it's something people should be very cautious about, to be sure. And again, if they're participating in a clinical trial, which are being held, clinical trials, you're working with doctors and so forth, and there's real control over the potential consequences. But that, even so, there are risks. In fact, the fellow I interviewed admitted there are risks to this. But if you're going out and buying mushrooms and taking mushrooms or scoring it, he used to say, some LSD or some other psychedelics, then I think you're kind of on your own, and you could get lost. I'm not an expert in psychedelics by any stretch, but I have seen, I lived through the 60s as a young man, and I have seen the consequences that followed from people using these substances. And while they are different from things such as cocaine and so forth, or heroin, they're still cause for great concern, and they are illegal, generally speaking. There are a few states like Oregon that has legalized the use of mushrooms. But even in Oregon, you have to do it under a certain controlled use rather than just grabbing the mushrooms and going home. So these are things to cause great concern. And on a larger scope, I worry about that to find meaning, we're turning to hedonism as a culture. And this is a form of that if you're using it recreationally and not trying to overcome some terrible depression through medical supervision. And we're seeing the hedonism arising, not just with the psychedelic issue, but with the pornography issue, with all the various kinds of vices that are now commonplace and that are used to stimulate people's adrenaline, I guess, to participate in and make money for various sectors of society. Gambling is another example. So I think that this is a symptom, not a cause, if you will.
I think that's an excellent point. And what strikes me when you think about and look at the overall, you know, mental health of our youth, it seems there's a lot more. You know, if this is the direction that we're going, it's empty, because people are still feeling that they can't compete, that they're not good enough. And they, you know, it's all about a dopamine rush, I guess. But the end point.
Well, we have a serious mental health issue and crisis going on in the culture, and we have to figure out why that is. And I have my opinions, but the idea that you're going to somehow overcome through psychedelics or through drug use or through pornography, these are the causes in some regards, not the cures.
Well, my question too is, what do they consider an interesting life? That's a very loaded statement. To make life interesting, what does that even mean to these people?
Well, you know, from the article, it basically, I'll read it to you. A psychologically rich life is a kind of good life. It's a life characterized by complexity, in which people experience a variety of interesting things. Well, it's kind of self, it's a wheel spinning on itself, isn't it? And feel and appreciate a variety of deep emotions via firsthand experiences or vicarious experiences. But you're talking about hallucinations. And they go on to write, characteristic psychedelic experiences, we suggest, with their range of felt emotions. Of course, people have emotions when they're on the trips, right? Mm-hmm. And often quite interesting content, kind of like it's almost as if they think it's a movie. Help to contribute to a psychologically rich life. No, that's escapism. That's escapism. You do not have a psychologically rich life when you find reality and meaning in hallucinations. You have a rich life when you participate in your society, when you have meaningful relationships with other people, when you experience and express love, when you experience and express forgiveness and mercy, when you participate in things that are greater than yourselves, when you give freely of yourself. That's how you have an emotionally rich life, not through taking substances that can alter your consciousness.
I couldn't have said it better. And the fact that you're trying to make something artificial, give it the same weight as living. You just describe what living is, you know, to go out there and have energy transfer between people where you're actually communicating, not this solo trip that's fake, that has no meaning in a sense. And if you really think about it, they're trying to redefine what living is. Doesn't it sound like that?
Yeah, and it's basically taking people out of life and into almost themselves, because the psychedelic experience or the drug high or the porn high isn't participated in with others. It's all solipsistic with yourself, and it's self-destructive.
I think that's an excellent way to see that. It seems that the society, even though we're talking about people being part of a whole or being a group, it actually is becoming more solo, more, you know, I guess, removed from reality. And if society...
Right. If you and I took psychedelics next to each other, we sat there holding hands, taking psychedelics, we'd have completely different experiences. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be participating with each other. We would be into our own hallucination, wherever that might lead us. Now, sometimes that might be pleasurable. Sometimes it's terrifying. There are many stories of people on psychedelics with terrifying experiences. So, and one could be one, and then one could be the other. So it is isolating. It is not being part of a richer culture or part of the human community.
It seems that's where we're moving, though, as a society. Sorry. On that note, let's take our first break, because I want to delve into this fake, you belong to this group, part of the human consciousness, but in actuality, it's divide and conquer. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Wesley Smith. And before the break, I think you did a really nice job of giving a breakdown of what this, I don't even want to call it, I think a new system that they're trying to create. It reminds me of the book Brave New World, where everything was about soma. So you can just disconnect and be hedonistic and not live an authentic life like the person who came into the society. But it's all about neurolinguistic programming, right? So you say something, it means the opposite, but it's said so much that people don't even know what the truth is. So if you're exploring these solo trips, how on earth, and is this the point, make you part of a society, make you God-fearing, give you something that ties us literally together, which is our spirit. God created us, and so we're all his children, right? If you're on this solo trip, does that remove you from this thought of a bigger, something bigger than you, something that's good?
Well, certainly, it would seem to me, during the experience, you are removed because you're focused completely on what your brain is shooting through your consciousness, whatever it might be. And of course, again, that's an hallucination. And I think Huxley really saw what was coming when he wrote Brave New World. I would urge your listeners to read the book. It was written in 1932. It came out in 32, which means he wrote it in 30-31. That's a long time ago. That's almost 100 years ago. And yet, what did he foresee? He foresee radical reproductive technologies. In the Brave New World, families don't exist. Women don't give birth. there's one character that says, we decant our children. It's a cloning process. It is a world in which families don't exist. It is a world in which people are not allowed to have the kind of connections you and I were talking about in the first segment, mutual connection. So you basically are on your own. You are required to be promiscuous in Brave New World because, you know, it's all about hedonism to keep you placated. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to have any kind of a serious discomfort, any discomfort at all, you're supposed to take the drug Soma, it's called, that'll make you feel good. There's genetic engineering of everybody so that you have a caste system that's created through the genetic, through the sheer manacles of genetic alterations. And so you have the alphas and the omegas and so forth. And these castes perform various functions. There's the leadership caste, there's the blue collar caste, and people are genetically engineered to be happy to be part of their caste. So there's no freedom. It's all basically slavery. And it really is the end of human life as you were describing it as human. And the interesting thing is there's one of the characters, I don't want to do a, I'm sure most people have read it, but one of the characters is called the Barbarian because he was born naturally. And he experiences aging naturally, and he rebels against the actual despotism that Brave New World is depicted as. And Huxley, when he wrote a foreword to a reedition of the book in 1949, so it came out first in 32. It was reissued again in 49, and he wrote a new introduction, and he said, when I wrote the book originally, I believed that the horrors of Brave New World would take 700 years to develop. He said, I believe now that they will be here by the end of the century, which is now. And to a large degree, he's absolutely correct, because you are seeing some of the things that Brave New World warned against developing, as we've been discussing.
I mean, it seems like very coordinated, right? So we're in this, you know, this next phase of this, but did it really start with secularization of our society? And it's been every country almost that's become very, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, they've pulled away from God and God's consciousness, and it's all about individualism. And not even individualism, because it's mostly the government running things, right? So it's not like you can be an individual. You have to conform.
I think there is a great deal of pressure in that regard. Some would say that Brave New World has met 1984, which is the great George Orwell dystopian novel. And of course, there have been efforts to stifle, particularly during COVID, to stifle heterodox opinions, even scientific opinions. For example, when Jay Bhattacharya and two other epidemiologists authored the Great Barrington Declaration, saying back in, I guess it was November 2020, you know, we should not be keeping kids out of school over COVID because it's going to cause more harm than good. And there are ways that we should approach this pandemic that are less destructive to society and still can protect people. And they were shut down by members of the government who started a whispering campaign against them. Francis Collins, who at the time was the head of the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, an email came out where he said, we've got to put down these people as fringe epidemiologists. They weren't fringe. Bhattacharya is at Stanford. He's written over 100 documents. One of the others was at Harvard. The other one was at Oxford. These were very prominent epidemiologists that Francis Collins and Anthony Fauci decided to undermine and prevent as best they could from expressing their opinions. These were people that were canceled on social media. Bhattacharya had Stanford try to actually punish him and things of this sort. So you do see some of that going on, but we also can't say it's succeeding because Bhattacharya has become very prominent and Fauci and Collins are no longer in government. And there is a robust discussion. And so the game is afoot, if you will. It has not been lost. And people need to step up and say, listen, I'm going to speak my mind. This is a free society, and be part of it. I do think that another point you made is real. We are entering, I don't think, just the post-Christian age, but the anti-Christian age. So I know that listeners to this program are predominantly Christian. Don't be surprised when people and when the main cultural organs despise and denigrate Christianity and Christians. In fact, as I recall, there was a great man who said, rejoice and be exceedingly great when this happens to you, because great is your reward in heaven. So that is part of the Christian walk, is potentially suffering, not social martyrdom, to be sure, which I think is what's coming in the United States. And in some places, like Nigeria, it's blood martyrdom.
I mean, from the standpoint of being able to be authentic and to live your life out, not in this hallucinogenic fugue state, it makes it, I think this is an extremely important article, because it tells, I think it tells our listeners where the society would like us to go. It's much easier.
Where the elites. Yeah. It's not, right now, and I'm doing a lot of writing from articles that are being published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which, as you know, is probably the most prominent medical journal in the world. Nature, which is the prominent, most prominent science journal in the world. The Lancet, which is another, in fact, it's the oldest medical journal in the world. Science, which is another great journal. The Journal of Medical Ethics, which published this psychedelic piece. This is where a lot of what's going to go wrong in the future can be determined, because it's often first published in these journals. And these journals have, not to 100%, but to a large degree, ceased to be scientific in the objective sense and become ideological in the subjective sense. And so there is a push for what might be called woke policies. There is a push, Dr. George, to push some of our most contentious political issues into the realm of public health, so that you can have a technocracy make the decisions about what to do about things such as racism and climate change, as opposed to making it part of the democratic process. So I think we're in a very fraught moment. And I do think there are great forces seeking to stifle particular perspectives. But I'm not sure that they're succeeding completely, because there is, I think, some significant and sometimes effective pushback.
And I think you're right. It gets to a point that when it touches the individual and they start to pull away from what they're seeing on the screen, and it's hitting them in the face, that they can't just ignore it anymore.
Look at the transgender issue, just as one example, where men who identify or feel like they're women have been permitted to play against women in women's sports. Well, you're beginning to see a huge pushback against that, where young women will refuse to compete in those circumstances because it's not a fair competition. Women are having their scholarships taken from them, and they're beginning to fight back, and you're beginning to see pushback. The same thing with the treating children who have gender dysphoria. With puberty blocking and surgeries such as mastectomies or facial reconstruction, there's a big pushback against that as well. There's a big pushback against the indoctrination in schools of some of these ideologies. And the outcome hasn't been determined, but people are not going to the slaughter, if you will, using a metaphor, like sheep.
Well, it's scientism, it sounds like, versus...
That's human, exactly what it is.
Versus human exceptionalism, right? These are the two pendulum swings that we are now in the process of needing to choose, no?
I think that's a very good way to put it. You do have scientism, and for people who may not know, scientism is not the same thing as science. It is an ideology. Science is a method by which you determine facts. So there's a method you go through of testing and falsification and various kinds of debates and challenging and so forth. That's a very contentious field, but the goal is to find what's true. Scientism is an ideology that says that science can tell us right from wrong, but science cannot tell us right from wrong. Science cannot set the morality of society. That's not something science is equipped to do. So when you see someone say, science says, for example, that abortion should be permitted, that's not science, that's scientism. What science can tell us is what is destroyed in an abortion, which is a gestating human being.
So from the standpoint of that, you know, we've again, isn't it neuro-linguistic programming to a degree to marry scientism to science? And I'm a scientist. I was a biology major. None of these things make sense. They don't have a control. They just have a conclusion and they produce the data to back up that conclusion. But it never seems to me now that it comes naturally, that you have a thesis and you need to prove it.
That's a good point. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's a good point, because what you're finding is that when you have science journals or medical journals that are ideological and not just objectively scientific, then the suspicion is going to arise that what they are going to print on issues such as like, does this particular chemotherapy affect liver cancer, but on issues of social contention, that when they print quote studies or supposed scientific papers on those contentious issues, that they're doing so to further ideology, and that if a very valid scientific paper came in with proper citations that could pass peer review and so forth, that went against the favored narrative, that it wouldn't have a prayer of being published. And that's why these institutions are falling into such distrust, because people are looking around and saying, wait a second, this is not the way science is supposed to work. You know, I'm sometimes asked, well, Wesley, why was, for example, Dr. Sabin, who developed the polio vaccine, why wasn't he a contentious person? Well, he wasn't a contentious person because he wasn't trying to change society into a particular image. He was trying to find a good vaccine that would prevent people from getting polio. There's a difference there. And I didn't mean to get here from psychedelics. But I think that this is all part of the same. These are all parallel issues that are moving in the same direction for the very reasons you described.
It's to me almost like a cause and effect. I mean, if you can try to coerce or cajole or in some way distract people while you move them to this system of, I mean, scientism, AI, it's all the same thing to me. It's not about human exceptionalism. And I want to ask you this question when we come back. So let's take our second break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Wesley Smith, and you can go to his website, humanize.today. You can read articles that he's written. He's got a wealth of information, podcasts. You can also listen to his podcasts on that site. And before the break, I wanted to try to draw a conclusion, or I should say a parallel, and get your opinion on this scientism, artificial intelligence, as if it is the next thing. Everything seems to be going towards AI, and because humans are somehow flawed and they can never compete. You know, what really strikes me is that AI doesn't just come out of a vacuum. It's created by humans. So if it's created by flawed beings, how on earth can it be perfect?
Well, it can't be perfect. And I think people are trying to, like transhumanists, which are trying to create they wanted to have immortality on this earth. And they think one way they're going to be able to do that is to upload their minds into AI computers. Well, AI is just a tool. It's a computer. It's not alive. It doesn't have consciousness. It may be incredibly sophisticated and able to make computations and so forth in a very blurringly fast way, but it is always going to be a slave to its programming because it can't go outside of its program because it's a computer. It's inanimate. It's a machine. And there are people who are trying to take AI and elevated to something that it cannot ever be, which is almost like a living entity. And there are people who actually want to say that if an AI attains, quote, consciousness, it should be considered a person like a human being is considered a person. Well, an AI cannot attain consciousness because it's not a living thing. It is an inanimate object. Human beings have intrinsic moral worth, and you can't even calculate it. An AI may be worth a heck of a lot of money, you know, it may be worth millions and millions of dollars, but in terms of intrinsic worth, it has no more value than a broken toaster because it's inanimate. It's a machine. It's a thing. It's a human tool. And as long as we make sure that AI retains human control and the understanding that it is a tool to help us achieve better human development and better human performance, that's one thing. If you decide that it is an entity unto itself, that's quite another. And I think what you're finding with a lot of what we've been discussing is that a lot of these new technologies are dual-edged swords. On one hand, you could have, just going back to the morphine example, you can prevent horrible pain for people suffering from terrible diseases. At the same time, it could be the cause of somebody becoming a terrible addict and addicted and having their life destroyed. It's not the thing itself, it's how we decide to use the thing.
That's a very good point. And, you know, they're pushing the envelope. It's been a while now, but you heard, I think it was Saudi Arabia who made an AI robot, gave them citizenship and a passport. I mean, that should have been stopped in its tracks. And there's people marrying robots and all sorts of weird stuff going on. I mean, obviously it's pushing the envelope, but is this moving the Overton window so that at some point that they become more powerful or given more rights than we are as human beings?
Well, there are movements to that effect. I have not heard about the Saudi Arabian issue example you gave me, but, and of course, some of this is people, you know, trying to get attention on the internet and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But there are very serious concerns here. And I think the transhumanist movement is an example of something that people should be very aware of. Transhumanism is about creating a post-human society and a post-human species. The transhumanist wants to use all of the various technologies that have been developed, biotech, which is some of the most powerful technology since the splitting of the atom. Right now, Dr. George, as you know, through the CRISPR genetic editing process, you can change every life form on the planet. You can change any cell. You can alter, bacteria and so forth. And there could be tremendous benefit. You could help ameliorate terrible genetic diseases. On the other hand, you could create a bird flu that turns into a terrible pandemic. So, and we're not getting a handle on this. I mean, the point is human control, but the transhumanists, because they have lost faith in the importance of being human, and because they have lost a belief in transcendence, now hope to create everything that religionists and theists would hope from faith and from God in the material world. And it's a fool's game because it's not going to work. It's not going to work. And if you try it too hard to go down that road, you're going to be pushing toward authoritarianism, toward eugenics, and various things that would be destructive to an equal and mutually loving society. You know, human exceptionalism is about two things. And in summary, I can say a third. It's about the unique dignity of human beings. Only we have this unique, incredible dignity. And it's equal. It doesn't matter whether you have a developmentally disability or you're Einstein. You're intrinsically equal. And the second is we have moral duties. We're the only moral species in the known universe. We can tell right from wrong. And that means we have an obligation to each other. We have an obligation to our posterity. When the founders of this country created the country, they talked often about their posterity, which is us. These are people we'll never meet. But we have an obligation to leave them with a better world than when we entered it. We have an obligation to treat animals humanely, which is a different issue, and to treat the environment responsibly, which is not the same thing as what's going on with the nature rights movement, which is trying to create personalities, personhood for things like rivers. And seven rivers in this world have been created to have, are now stated to have rights. So what does human exceptionalism boil down to that the other issues that we've been discussing don't have? Love. Human exceptionalism is about love. When you're trying to go within yourself in a psychedelic trip, that's not about love. That's about, in my view, almost despair. It's about trying to escape. And as you said, it's not about being part of a community. It is part of being a solipsistic, isolated individual. And if we start to think of ourselves as islands, we're to use that phrase, we're looking for big trouble. So the answer is to embrace human exceptionalism, embrace each other, be part of community, help each other through difficult times, rejoice with each other in happy times, and be part of a culture, not an isolated, hedonistic, pleasure-seeking, almost non-human.
You know, there's one word that comes to mind when you discuss, when you put it into terms like that, and it's conscience, right? Do you have the conscience to feel empathy for somebody? I don't think that pathway is about empathy. It can't be by definition.
Yeah, by definition, because you're not, it's not suffering with.
Uh-huh.
Compassion means to suffer with. That's the root meaning. That you're not suffering with anyone. When a hospice nurse applies morphine to a dying patient with cancer, that's suffering with. That's helping somebody. When somebody goes to a street encampment with heroin and gives out heroin, which some cities do, and gives out the needles, that's not suffering with. That's doing too. That's harming. So again, we find ourselves with two different paths. One is the path of inclusion, and one is the path of individualism and isolation.
You know, if you go down the path of individualism, it makes it easy in some senses to ignore and be compassionate, because it's about the betterment of, in their opinion, the betterment of society, and getting rid of people who are somehow weaker. And, you know, I know you've read about these new policies. I mean, Canada comes to mind, that there's a track that people can want to commit euthanasia, you know, can kill themselves because of non-lethal illnesses. You know, you're depressed.
Yeah, they're actually killed by doctors in a lethal injection. And Canada, which is our closest cultural cousin, so it's something to be very concerned about. Last year, more than 15,000 patients were euthanized, many of them not, as you said, not terminally ill, and you shouldn't euthanize terminally ill people either. In the Netherlands and in Belgium, mentally ill people are euthanized. So, you know, if someone's suicidal with a mental illness, and the treatment is to kill them. I mean, that's just insane.
How did we make that jump? How did, you know, in your opinion, I took a Hippocratic oath and it's do no harm. Euthanasia was not part of what my oath was. How did we morph from that to where we stand now? And with no, you know, no conscience, really. It's just, this is what it is, and it's a good thing.
A whole show could be done on this, but what's happened is that for many people, the purpose of society has ceased to be the number one purpose, the prime directive, protecting the innocent and protecting innocent human life. It has become eliminating suffering. And if eliminating suffering becomes your prime goal, that easily mutates into eliminating the sufferer. And then what constitutes, as we've seen in Canada, suffering that justifies being eliminated expands very quickly. And eventually you end up with a very nihilistic society, a dark society, a death-on-demand society. The German highest constitutional court has created in Germany a constitutional right, fundamental, they said, because of autonomy, to commit suicide for any reason. We're not just talking about limitations caused by health issues or disabilities. Any reason, a right to have assistance in suicide, and a right, if asked, to assist in suicide. That's death on demand. And so we might as well, in that circumstance, you're basically saying that human life doesn't have any intrinsic value unless somebody actually wants to live. Well, there are a lot of people, and I'll bet some listening to your show right now, who may have been suicidal and who didn't want to live, but their society loved them enough to intervene and help them get through that darkness with suicide prevention until they got out the other side. If we start abandoning people to this kind of despair, then in the end, none of us is safe, because none of us knows if life throws us a real curve, how we might react. We need to be there for people, even when they don't feel they can be there for themselves.
That's a wonderful point. On that note, let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Wesley Smith. And Mr. Smith, how can people, when does your podcast run so people can listen to it live?
Well, it's not live. It's posted after I recorded it.
Gotcha.
But it runs every 2 weeks. If you go to humanize.today, you can go to the podcast. And I've interviewed some very interesting people. I've interviewed the novelist Dean Koontz, you know, the famous thriller novelist. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed Sam Brownback a couple of times, who's the he's former senator from Kansas. Former governor of Kansas, who now is a major advocate for religious freedom. I've interviewed that Jay Bhattacharya, who we discussed, who wrote the Great Barrington Declaration, and so forth. I've interviewed people who disagree with me about things such as animal rights. I interviewed Gary Francione, who's an animal rights law teacher, who believes that humans don't have any right to own animals for any reason, and we had a long discussion. I interviewed Thomas Lindsay, who's the founder of the nature rights movement, about how he believes that we have to basically dismantle human society, our capitalistic society, and remake it and use nature rights as the spear, if you will. So I hope people will listen, but after they finish listening to your podcast, of course.
Oh, you're so kind. I think those are excellent things that people really need to expand their consciousness. We get so boxed in following, coloring between the lines, and I don't think people feel safe at this point to explore. And we're being led, you know, if it's the AI, you do a search on the internet, for example, the AI answer pops up first now. You have to actually have to go and do your research. So I think I challenge everybody.
Yeah, it's becoming harder, actually, to find things.
It is. That's why people need to find your podcast, because it challenges you to think outside the box, cite your source, examine why you feel some way. Is it because someone told you to? Was it because it was easy? Was it because laziness? Honestly, I think do you think that's part of what plagues us, is this inability to put some sweat equity into anything?
That's an interesting question. In my experience, I've been doing this kind of work for 30 years plus. I'm sensing a certain exhaustion, especially on the part of people who might be more traditional. And they're getting to the place where things have gotten so radical that they're basically saying, fine, do what you want, just leave me alone. Problem is, they're not going to leave you alone. And as we've seen just in the transgender issue, where parents are losing their children if they refuse to go along with gender dysphoria. So it's a very difficult time, and, you know, people have to engage it. If you engage it, you can defeat it. If you decide, well, I just don't have the time or the energy and I'm too depressed, well, then, you know, we'll get what we ask for.
Well, this is where the psychedelics come in, right? When you're tired and depressed, you can escape with this. You know, I love it. They have the problem, reaction, and the solution, right? You create this nihilistic, empty society, and all of a sudden we got the perfect way for you to escape. And it's, you know, it's socially and it's legal and all these other things. And just because it's there doesn't mean you should, right? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And there's something to be said for working, for struggling, finding an answer, getting to the other side, because it gives you so much perspective and power that if something comes up again, you know it's trash. You know you're not going to fall into some sort of trap. But it also makes our society stronger.
I think that's right.
Yeah, don't you think it's like, you know, I want to, yeah. you think about the whack-a-mole phenomenon. People stand up and you see them might, you know, they have to suffer some consequence, but you can't get all the moles, can you? So if people people keep putting their head
there's
up.
There's always new moles popping up.
That's correct.
And my arm gets tired.
Too true. Another thing I wanted to ask you is about your take on our healthcare system. We talked about it briefly with the this movement towards euthanasia. But did you foresee that the healthcare system wouldn't be about healthcare, that it would be an arm of control?
That's interesting. I think what's happening with healthcare is it's being moved outside of the normal sphere of medicine and becoming something that supposedly is to help us live fulfilled and happy lives, which of course is not the medical purpose. The medical purpose is to promote healing and wellness and to take care of people when they're sick. So you have, I think, the healthcare system being asked to do more than it can. And the costs of that, I think, are putting great strain on the healthcare system. And we seem to be incapable of having a rational discussion about how our health medical system should work. I mean, our system has real problems in terms of, various issues such as private insurance and, mm-hmm. and the Medicare and so forth. But if you look at Canada, which is a socialized system, it takes 9 months to see an oncologist in some places when you've been diagnosed with cancer. In fact, there have been a couple of examples I'm aware of people who were euthanized because they couldn't get proper care in Canada. The NIH, which is a different socialized system in England, is also having a catastrophic meltdown. So I think what we need to find is a mixed approach that allows proper access to good health care for as many people as we can, but at the same time doesn't include everything people might want. What is essential to be provided, for example, saving a life, should have a higher priority than something such as, well, I think I would like to have this a different look on my face. It's a huge discussion that, I can't do justice to in a quick answer.
Well, I would pick up the baton on that and say, if we could get the middlemen out of medicine and healthcare, because it used to be the doctor and the patient, and there's 1,000 people in between now, between the government and commercial insurance and private equity people, you name it, everybody's feeding at this trough, and the cost is not true. It's not a real cost center anymore. And if we could just strip that out and go back to whatever the doctor and the patient decide should be done, and it should not have fees and all these other things that are arbitrary tacked on, maybe we could move back towards responsibility, self-responsibility, patients being able to take care of themselves. I mean, people don't go because they can't afford it, right? So they end up getting sicker because of cost. So the system is literally kind of geared towards high ticket, very little healthcare, just like you described. But I don't believe doing the same thing, expecting a different result, is going to be the answer here. And euthanizing people or somehow limiting their care, managing their care, who gets to manage? It's never the patient, right? It's never the family. It's always someone who stands to gain, and it's in opposition to the patient's health.
And too often, not always, obviously, it can deny the exceptional equality of the patient. Now, mm-hmm. I have to say that most of the people working in healthcare in the trenches, do really good work and really care about their patients. I worry about the elites that seek to set policy.
Well, yeah, that policy, unfortunately, is affecting delivery at this point. Hopefully you're not in anywhere near the system, but it's now being frontline driven by people who are physicians, right? So it used to be, I used to do a talk, I don't know, maybe about 10 years ago, and it was like a 17-to-1 administrator to doctor ratio in a hospital setting. That's ridiculous. Those guys, they don't deliver care. Why are they there? If you cut out a quarter of them, it would be cheaper. So it's all of that. No one listens to what they say they do, but they don't listen to what doctors and patients are saying, which are easy fixes most of the time. but
and doctors are under great stress.
Oh, for sure.
In that circumstance, yeah, they're under great stress.
I mean, I think as we talked about the stress level and mental health that's running rampant in the healthcare space as well, between medical students and doctors and the suicide rate, people don't talk about that, but it's actually amazingly high, which I never would have thought. And it's because your autonomy is being stripped. This is as it everybody in the society who wants to run their life, whether they're a construction worker, a housewife, whatever, there's a lot of entities that are coming in between and deciding what your worth is and how much you should be compensated, whether that's your time, money, whatever, your retirement. It's just really tragic. And I agree with you. We now have to take account of it and take power back because of it.
If we don't, no one else will.
I absolutely agree with you. There's one more. I know we're almost done, but I just wanted to touch base about one last thing. And the public health sector, you know, that's another arm of this where you've got this administrative layer that gets to decide policy. And it's funny, every decision that seems to go on, it doesn't really end up the way it's supposed to, right? It's supposed to be about public health, about access, about, you know, being able to help the individual technically, but it's always some sort of herd mentality. And it's never in a direction that makes sense to me. Do you see that? Do you feel that?
Well, the public health sector, unfortunately, has become ideological and are more interested in promoting certain cultural changes, I think, than they are in maintaining a proper boundary for public health policies. Again, it's a huge discussion, and I don't want to overgeneralize in a short answer, but I've written quite a bit about it. And so if people want to go to my work on the WHO, CDC, and so forth, there are concerns. And again, it flows from ideology and a desire to create a technocracy, in my opinion, where the experts decide. And that's not the role of public health. The role of public health is to recommend to policymakers who have to look at various issues when they make policy-making decisions, not just the health issue, but just as a quick example, keeping kids out of school. Well, the public health people like Dr. Fauci or Dr. Collins were saying, well, we got to keep the kids from getting COVID. And then people like Jay Bhattacharya were saying, yeah, but you know what? The kids don't have any real danger from COVID. And if you keep them out of school, you're going to cause great social dislocation. Now, that's not something that either Dr. Jay Bhattacharya or Dr. Collins should have decided. It should be policymakers who take all of these various issues, because everything is not in an isolation. Things all impact each other. So public health, I think, is certainly an important sector, but we can't let it become the controlling sector.
That's well said. You know, in the minute that we have left, again, how can people read what you write, listen to your podcast, and learn a lot from you?
Thank you. Humanize.today. I'm on Twitter at the Wesley J. Smith. It's the Wesley J. Smith because when I try to do at Wesley J. Smith, somebody beat me to it. I write a lot on National Review. If you go to National NRO, nationalreview.com, and look for the authors, and my archive will show up. I write in the Epic Times sometimes. I write in other places as well.
Mr. Smith, I want to thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. I learned so much, and I know my listeners do too.
Thank you, Dr. George, for having me. I appreciate the support.
Oh, anytime. Thank you very much, and thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.